Hello, I'm Peter Clark in Melbourne, Australia. This is another Inside Story podcast, and today I've come to the vast biomedical precinct here in Melbourne, to the Bio 21 Institute Laboratories, to meet Chris Armstrong, who's a researcher in the very controversial area of chronic fatigue syndrome. Chris, welcome to Inside Story.
Thank you, Peter.
We're going to delve into some of the details of your research, but first of all, let's just set the scene a little bit. I think chronic fatigue syndrome, and I'm a little bit embarrassed to even use that phrase these days, even the name of it's very controversial, but the history of chronic fatigue syndrome, ME/CFS, is a very troubled one, isn't it?
It's particularly troubled, I think, because of the way that the diagnosis has come about. It's taken a long time to find biochemical features for this disorder. And so the difficulty has been that a doctor may not have been able to diagnose this condition and may be put into the too hard basket. And then that has become a difficult process in itself to then study these people, because diagnosing it was purely based on a broader range of symptoms. It's been diagnosed based on the exclusion of any other disorder. And so in a way, it's hard to know exactly the group that you're studying, how homogeneous they are. And if it's a heterogeneous disorder, when comparing that to a control group, it's been difficult to get replicated results in biochemical features. But we are starting to get a lot of really good data now that we're looking at metabolites and immune features and more advanced technologies.
Chris, when did ME/CFS first come onto the radar medically? Are we going back a generation at least?
Probably the first time it was recognized was called a polio-like illness back in the 1950s. And since then, it showed up in outbreaks in hospitals or in certain situations, like the chemical outbreaks, and these people would get like this long-term fatigue profile, and it was unexplainable. It kind of came about as this flu-like illness, but they couldn't actually find a virus to actually say that it was a virus. That was the beginning of it. And because it was a flu-like illness, it showed it all the hallmarks of a flu, which was long-term or chronic. They actually, because they couldn't find a virus, then they concluded that there was something else. And then in the 1980s, a cohort or a group came together, and they actually put together a group of diagnostics for this new disorder that they would call chronic fatigue syndrome. And from that, they refined the diagnostic more and more to say that it's 6 months of persistent fatigue with a number of associated symptoms. And that diagnosis has also been refined a little bit over the years. The one that's been used for most consensus has been the Fukuda one in 1994. And since then, there's been ones in 2003. And even recently, there's been new ones.
Yet, as I do some of the research, look up some of the forums around ME/CFS, I see that there are still CFS deniers, medical scientists, who say it doesn't exist. How is it possible to have so much research going on and yet some in the business still saying it doesn't exist?
I think that's about maybe not acknowledging the current research that's out there, because there is significant amounts of research in regards to the biochemical profiles of it. We take the blood or urine from people with chronic fatigue syndrome and compare them to controls, and we get significant variations. And without even telling an algorithm that they are chronic, they have this disorder, they will separate them from controls. So they're purely just telling you that the people with chronic fatigue syndrome, their blood is significantly different to the blood of someone with who is healthy.
So what is the nub of your research as we speak today?
The main part of my research is to look at the metabolites in blood, urine and fecal samples, and I look at the microbiota in the fecal samples as well. So the reason why we look at the microbiota is because we have, in our lab previously, we had found that there was a significant microbial difference within the fecal matter of people with chronic fatigue syndrome compared to controls. It's called a gut dysbiosis, and this can lead to such issues as leaky gut syndromes, but it could also cause chronic inflammation or chronic immune activation issues within the body itself if you are growing pathogenic bacteria, which can then translocate into the blood, which is when they actually move into the blood, which is quite a natural event. When people exercise, you tend to release a few bacteria from your gut into your bloodstream. But if they are of a different type to normal, then they might be causing increased response of immunity, which might be an issue. And that follows on with other research in chronic fatigue syndrome, which have found this chronic immune activation. There are alterations in their immune system. They have differences in cytokines, which are signals for inflammation. And there are also issues with oxidative stress, which was one of the basic forms of immune defense against bacteria.
Many conditions have a spectrum, don't they, from very mild right through to very severe. Already your description seems very multifactorial. Are we also talking about that inevitable severity spectrum in this condition?
Yeah, so we are talking about a spectrum condition. I think a lot of these chronic disorders tend to be spectrum disorders because they're finding that our disease itself is quite individual. Once you are in a stress system, there are parts about the way that you entered that stress system and also the genes or the predisposing factors you have to get that disorder can be varied, and everyone has slight variations in their genes and they can cause very minor changes in function, not necessarily alterations, large alterations or noticeable alterations in function, but we are all quite different. And so that really comes, I think, to a forefront when you're looking at a chronic disorder.
Clinically, are you drawing upon people within this precinct who are being treated by various doctors who have reported chronic fatigue syndrome? Are you using these sort of cohorts to get your samples, or are you reaching further afield?
So we work with a clinic out in Donvale. It's called the CFS Discovery Clinic. It's run by Dr. Don Lewis, and he's been working with chronic fatigue syndrome for about 20 years. And we're very lucky, actually, to have that sort of a clinic, because it's quite rare to find people specialising as GPs in the field of chronic fatigue syndrome. So we use him to actually get the samples that we run, and we have a close working relationship with him, which has actually made it very, very useful, because we can dictate the way that we want the samples collected, how we carefully freeze or handle the samples afterwards, which is really important when you're looking at blood or urine or fecal samples or any type of biofluid sample, because metabolites themselves, the things that we are trying to measure, will degrade quite rapidly. They also fluctuate quite rapidly. So even an individual, when you wake up in the morning, when you eat food, when you exercise, your metabolites are actually changing in your blood all the time to varying degrees. So they can also change with the illness severity. So there are a lot of factors you need to look at. And the way that you usually handle that is by looking at large populations. So if you look at a large enough population of people taking their metabolites and their concentrations within an experimental case group compared to a control, then you actually find the underlying biochemical change, where they all might have differences from individual to individual, but there's an underlying thread throughout which you can kind of tease away from the large population.
It seems to me you're dealing with a moving target nevertheless, so there's a lot of complexity here.
Yeah, there is quite a lot of complexity. There's quite a few targets we need to hit in chronic fatigue syndrome. One of the main ones has been identifying it as being different from healthy with all these metabolic studies. And there's been three or four now that have all found this significant difference. The hallmark term for it now is a hypermetabolism. So people with chronic fatigue syndrome, their concentration of metabolites seemed across the board decreased. You know, they'll still have an increase in some and a decrease in others, but overwhelmingly there is a significant decrease.
As part of the research, you're dealing with quite large groups of people and looking at quite a big range of variables. But if we home in on one particular patient, how can your research lead to providing assistance to that individual patient?
There's kind of a changing paradigm in the way that people are going towards personalised medicine. One of the good examples for this is a guy called Michael Schneider out of Stanford University. He did this work and he called it an IPOP study. But essentially you follow an individual, you look at their genes and you follow them throughout a long period of time. You might test them with things like exercise and different types of diets and treat them over that period of time, and you actually take, you know, symptoms or other or markers and their metabolites across that journey. And so what you actually find is you see how an individual varies over time. And so what you can actually see is what biochemical markers or features are present when they are at their best and when they are at their worst, how they deal with exercise, how they deal with food, how they deal with certain types of food, all this sort of stuff coming together, and you actually get indication of that person's individual illness to an extent. And so then when you treat them, you can also see whether your treatments are actually improving them or not. And so when it comes to the individual, these longitudinal trials, we believe, will be the way that you actually treat them. And this is not just in chronic fatigue syndrome, this is coming up in all sorts of fields. So Michael Schneider deals with diabetes, but there are lots of people here working in the Melbourne Brain Centre who are trying to get onto this level. And also CSL, which shares the building here in Bio21, we're actually looking, I think, to extend the building itself and create a personalised medicine.
So you've got the individual approach, you have the large scale groups of patients, and you're looking at underlying patterns. I haven't heard you use the term cause and effect at all yet. Is this leading to some insight into what everyone's busting to know, I suppose, particularly if they're suffering from chronic fatigue syndrome, ME/CFS? Cause and effect, that's the holy grail here, I suppose. Ultimately, is there some insight into cause and effect?
Cause and effect is the holy grail of science research, of course. And once you've obviously established that, you've cracked the illness itself. So getting to that stage is obviously quite difficult. At this point, what you do is observation. And we're working in the field of observational science, observing the person as the disease as it exists or sits within the person, trying to work out how to really tease away the disease from the individual and work out which is causing which. That's always the difficult thing. And I guess the only way to really do that is to create animal models, or they set up a situation where they can create the illness in something and then take it away. It takes a long time to get to that point, especially with regulations and ethical procedures. You can't just create situations where you're causing this illness and then taking it away until you're very sure. So because there's no animal model existing at this stage in chronic fatigue syndrome, that's probably a while away. But even saying that, I think the longitudinal studies where you're actually looking at things that at least are cause and effect in terms of stresses when they have the illness is giving you some indication. So if you're causing exercise and you're seeing their payback from that exercise, and that's a cause and effect, and you're seeing why their cause and effect, which is exercise to metabolite changes, might be actually different from a cause and effect in a healthy control person. And I think that dynamic of that disorder is a kind of a way to observe at least how a cause and effect is different in people with the disease and without.
Is there still something of an overhang that this is also a psychological condition? Your main focus is biochemical, obviously, and metabolisms. Is that still part of the overall fabric of this research, that there are some people in the area who still see it as partly, at least, a psychological condition?
Well, I think there are always going to be people who see it that way, and they probably field their research in this area. But the overwhelming majority is it's all biochemical research or genetic research or immunological research. And neurological research is occurring in chronic fatigue syndrome as well. It's more the, I guess, the psychological or the psychiatry background. But even that's changing in the world right now. A lot of illnesses that were considered psychological, they're looking at them in a biochemical way now. They're looking at stuff through neuroscience. And this is, you know, giving us a step forward. And they were also delayed in their ability to find this. I mean, chronic fatigue syndrome, it was delayed because they couldn't find a biochemical feature. It wasn't an easy answer. And I think the same thing is occurring with mental illness. They didn't have the technology to look at the brain, and now they do. And now they're getting better technologies to look at the brain, because it is an organ like the liver and the heart. And because we think with it, we think we're driving this tool. It's a tool. And so, you know, you're driving this tool and you believe that you're in control of it, but like a car, you know, it could break down and you don't have that control anymore. So that's really what they're kind of looking at. It's more about becoming, I guess, mechanics of the brain itself has helped. And with chronic fatigue syndrome, the same has occurred. We're just looking at something else that might be related. And so psychosomatic illness has got a bad reputation, because technically your brain can control stress molecules, it can control all sorts of things, and you can get physiological effects from the way that you perceive stress. I mean, that's just the environment. You know, your brain is really controlling your external environment and how, you know, how it can help you as an individual. But in terms of psychosomatic illness as it has been in the history books, well, that's something that is not being looked at with chronic fatigue syndrome much anymore. And definitely the funding and the weight of research is all pointing towards the physiological research now, which is fantastic.
When I first started reading about this as a pure layperson, I was really taken by this description of CFS as a mitochondrial disease. Mitochondria has an awful lot to do with the energy in each particular cell. That all seems to make sense, that if someone's really knocked for six and can barely get out of bed, that starts to make sense as a layperson. Take us deeper into that.
So the common findings that we found in chronic fatigue syndrome has been a dysfunction in the mitochondria. That's been one of the prime findings, along with an increase of oxidative stress. And they do go together because the oxidative stress condition and mitochondrial issues are one somewhat related, because the oxidative stress actually can knock out the enzymes within the TCA cycle, but also within the mitochondria, but the mitochondria itself is a source of oxidative stress.
What exactly is oxidative stress?
So oxidative stress is when you have too many reactive oxygen species being created within a mitochondria or within a cell, and that then can turn off your mitochondria. And then you get a situation where your oxygen levels, if your mitochondria aren't functioning as well, because your mitochondria are what uses oxygen, that's aerobic respiration. That uses oxygen, it creates carbon dioxide, and that's what you're breathing in and breathing out, is purely to fuel mitochondria. If they stop functioning, if they stop being able to use that oxygen, then the oxygen can just start filling up and it starts activating a lot of different enzymes which are created there to create reactive oxygen species. And usually it's seen as somewhat as a signaling issue. There is still even controversy as to whether it's a supremely negative thing. Some people think it's just for a signaling issue for the body to tell them that it's stressed, and it upregulates all these enzymes which might get them out of that stress situation. But it's kind of like it's a difficult thing trying to work out which one is causing which, whether the reactive oxygen species is causing the dysfunction in mitochondria, or the mitochondria are creating the reactive oxygen species, which then causes the dysfunction.
There seem to be a lot of international research centres tackling various aspects of all this. You're going gangbusters on it here, but what about your international colleagues? I guess you're in touch with them and reading all their research as well. Are you all harnessed and moving in the same direction, or are there various pulls in different directions?
I think we are all harnessed. There are different replication of the same findings that we have, which is the mitochondrial dysfunction, the oxidative stress. There's also the increased use of amino acids and lipids to create energy. And there's also gut dysbiosis issues that we all seem to be finding, and issues in the immune system. So they're all these same factors that keep coming out in different ways. This is probably the most exciting time in chronic fatigue syndrome research, because we're getting such a solid replication of all these factors. And these things have been found before in the past, even 10 years, decades before. But the replication of these studies is what's important, and the advancement of the technologies to do so. In terms of some of the interesting research that's come out, there's quite a bit coming out of the US, and there's quite a bit coming out of Norway. In Norway, they're doing trials on this drug called rituximab. It reduces the number of B cells in a patient, and that's seemingly having some positive effects, which they're testing through. And that same study group has recently found some interesting changes in the blood, I believe, though I don't think that's been released yet. And then in the US, there's groups associated with Stanford, a lot to do with the Open Medicine Foundation over there, and they're actually finding metabolite issues as well. And it's really being led over there by Ron Davis, who is a professor at Stanford, and he's running quite large studies in terms of metabolomics, genetics studies as well. And interestingly, we have the same sort of path in terms of the way that we're going through these studies. So, and I think that was purely coincidental. So it's great that people are seemingly on the same sort of path and trajectory, because what it means is we can replicate each other's work as we're going through.
Chris, I've had a few friends who have been diagnosed with this condition, and one of the things they've cried out is about the lack of any therapies or assistance. You know, they go through hell, some of them, as you well know. Has that improved? Are some of the researches you're doing leading at least to some of these speculative therapies to assist people?
Because myalgic encephalomyelitis, chronic fatigue syndrome, has been so poorly funded for so long, there's been just a stalling in all things, diagnostic, treatments, etiology, trying to work out what's causing it. So all this stuff together is, we're all trying to do that now, that we actually are getting funding involved, and America is actually engaging the NIH, which is the National Institute of Health over there, which is organises all the funding for different disorders, and they're actually engaging them quite strongly, and we're getting lots of funding through there, and this is what's causing this push through. So they are at the same time creating treatments. Everything that we can find in terms of etiology, it's all kind of happening at the same time. So when I mentioned the longitudinal studies, we're doing that in terms of trying to find the etiology of what's occurring, but at the same time you're monitoring someone, you're monitoring whether, if they get better, what metabolites are changing, what biochemical changes are occurring if they get better, and then you go, well, what is that metabolite? You know, why is that running with the fact that they're getting better? And if we then give them more of that, is that going to improve their outcome? And so it's kind of like this is the idea of personalized medicine, where you closely monitor someone for a long period of time, and then you can enact changes based on what they're telling you, their body is telling you, what's actually working well for them.
From that, it certainly doesn't sound like it's going to be a one-size-fits-all.
No, it won't be a one-size-fits-all. And part of the technologies of today are actually making this happen, because monitoring of this sort of diseases has actually occurred before. This actually does happen in when you go to a hospital. If you have an acute disorder or something like that, you'll be put on a drip. They'll have all these monitors around measuring different parts of your body, and they will, you know, they might put different drugs in you to try and make you feel better, or add certain things to make you feel better, and if you're improving those levels, then they know they're doing the right thing. It's the same process, except it's a long period of time, because it's a chronic illness, and hospitals can't obviously hold people for that long a period of time to really treat them for this long. So what's actually happening, it's like the enhancement of all this mobile tech that's really helping with this sort of stuff. So they're actually getting different technologies to monitor people over time. Sugars and lactates and all that sort of stuff are starting to be developed to be monitored by these apps. And even the Fitbit sort of stuff, giving people information over time about these individuals. And so that, and also these technologies with the metabolite data, we're trying to get it so it's actually quite cost effective at the same time. Obviously, initially it's going to be expensive monitoring an individual and altering them as they go, but slowly over time it will become more and more cost effective. And that's where I guess we see all personalized medicine for all chronic illnesses is going to go down that avenue.
Where in this journey are we? Are we almost just at the beginning of what's going to be a very, very long journey? Or do you feel more optimistic than that we're much closer now to helping people with this particular syndrome?
Yeah, I feel very optimistic actually about it. There are a lot of signs. I think the way that we're actually doing the research, the way that people are all kind of coming together, and it's becoming almost in science, it's almost becoming sort of like a semi-competitive sort of atmosphere, which is a really, really good sign, because it's coming to a point where it feels like, you know, in the next year or so, you know, there'll be the large crux of this disorder will be discovered. I mean, when we started with this metabolite work and chronic fatigue syndrome, at the time, one of the major findings was regarding to this virus that people thought maybe people had with chronic fatigue syndrome, but that turned out to be completely false. And so we thought we were on our own here, just doing this metabolite work for a few years. But then all of a sudden, all these people jumping on into the same field. We kind of thought it was the answer back then, and the fact that the more and more people are validating it and the more people are coming in to this area, it just, you know, we're obviously extremely excited, because we still believe it's the answer. And this is kind of being a validation process that all these other people are also seeing this as the case.
Chris, thank you very much for sharing a bit of your research today with us on Inside Story, and all power to you. Thank you.
And thank you very much, Peter, for having me on.
Chris Armstrong, researcher here at Bio21 Institute, part of the University of Melbourne and part of the even grander Biomedical Research Precinct here in Melbourne, Australia. I'm Peter Clark for Inside Story. Talk to you again soon.